This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Jan Bartlett. 2 hours of current affairs, followed by Done By Law, presented by the Federation of Community Legal Centres. And thanks to Anne McAllister for her hourly Celtic folk show. And you can listen on analogue 855, you can listen on digital 3CR, or you can stream and podcast through the webpage 3cr.org.au. Thanks for listening. Today we hear from a former national head of the US group Veterans for Peace, talking about an 40-year fast for Palestine. Nick McClellan, journalist with Islands Business, and the so-called historic decision in Paris regarding New Caledonia. James Hiller from the Deep Sea Mining Campaign and the increasing push for deep sea mining. And finally, part three of the webinar, looking at the Zionist lobby's influence in Australian politics and media. But first, Mr. Kevin Healy with his week that was.
A week, Jan, listener, when very, very exciting news this week. A new segment, not just for the week that was, but for 3CR. Guaranteed to make simple something most of us are finding increasingly confusing. But I'll keep you in suspense, listener, and come back to it shortly. It truly is the most exciting news we've had in a long, long time. Perhaps the most exhilarating since former Big Supremo Little Johnny Howhard lost his seat. Even if that Maxine McHugh one did take a bit of the gloss off it. But it week when big decisions highlighted the sheer common sense of international bodies on the one hand and the law on the other. Last week, we complimented our Minister for Environmental Disasters, Murray Stirs the Environment, for attacking a rational Save Our Songlines Terra Nullius non-land, non-people for opposing the destruction of their 50,000-year-old rock art, putting those 50,000 years above the interests of Woodside with profits, far more important 40 years, at least 40 years, of profit thanks to Murray and the socialist team. Selfish, selfish, non-land, non-people. But thank goodness, UNESCO, despite expressing concern that Murray and the team's gas threatened the sacred sites, nonetheless placed them on the heritage list, pure common sense. Well, they'll stay on the heritage list until the gas obliterates them. No, that reflects my bias. Two knowledgeable men, Murray and the Western Troubler Aussie Supremo Roger Cook the Planet, both acclaimed the UNESCO decision proved industry and the rock art can coexist. And don't forget, Roger informed us last week, good old fossil gas is the key to decarbonisation, which is on one level 100% true, if we stopped using it. And the law put in a determined bid to challenge UNESCO for reasoned logic, the federal court agreeing that Murray and the team's determined attack on climate change, if there is such a thing, by approving gas and coal, was singing the Torres Strait Islands and destroying their environment. Yes, His Honour was highly critical of the socialists and thus asked to rule that they had a duty of care to protect the Terra Nullius non-land, non-people's islands, prevent the destruction the government policy, non-action was causing. It was a no-brainer. He ruled against the non-land, non-people. The government can destroy them to its heart's content, showing sensibly, sensible capitalist law knows what needs protecting. The socialists rebutted criticism of its gas policy brilliantly, pointing out it has done more to address climate change, if there is such a thing, than the caring business class party hayseed and sheepshit coalition lot. As a rebuttal and offence, we're not sure that's the most potent. They simply had to do something. Then the Victorian Court of Appeal threw in a serious bid to outdo UNESCO and the federal His Honour, although I think it's close to a triple dead heat, dismissing a Department of Workplace Relations prosecution of Bruck Textile Technologies, real name, which hit the old financial brick wall. Bruck law-abiding, caring employers Philip Bart and Ronald Johnson, law-abiding because their honours ruled they were lawful in owing their lazy, avaricious workers $3.5 million. and probably a fair bit in super. See, the bill was picked up by the public purse through the taxpayer-funded safety net, the government alleging they intended to dud their workers and wanting its money back. But their honour showed the sheer logic of capitalist law, ruling that, this is true, listener, if directors believe their employees will be paid through the safety net, they are not criminally liable under the corporation's law offence banning deals that avoid employee entitlements. What a sensible, practical ruling. On that ruling, the public purse should be responsible for all workers dudded of their entitlements. Dudded? Tut, tut, Kevin, how unfair. Good, caring employers, knowing that to observe the law as ruled by their honours, they know the public purse will meet their responsibilities, which are not their responsibilities, but our responsibilities. Hard as it is to believe, the government suggests maybe the law needs a bit of a change, like making directors and or related entities responsible for worker entitlements. Good grief, do they want to put the public safety net out of business? But we must heap praise on one very caring employer, multinational childcare corporate Busy Don't Bees Pregnant, which employed a new human relations business partner so impressed with her, they pleaded with her to reduce her three-month notice period, which she did at that time, discovering she was pregnant, informed Busy Don't Bees Pregnant, and was told she didn't have the job after all. Poor Busy Don't Bees. She's claiming discrimination, taking the case to the True Blue Aussie Human Rights Commission under the Socialist Respect at Work laws. Her lawyer and she are making silly, irrational, anti-caring employer comments like, a company that profits from parenthood shouldn't be tearing up employment contracts with pregnant employees. What sort of message does this send to the thousands of mothers who place their children in the care of this company because they have to work? What silly comments. Of course Busy Not Bees has nothing against pregnancy. It's the basis of its profits, the more the wealthier, but understandably not when it comes to its own workers. And once again, thank goodness for the common sense of capitalist law. See, if Busy Not Bees loses the discrimination case, it faces the full force of the Respect at Work law. And the crippling penalty is? Well, there's no penalty. The socialists just forgot to add that bit to the legislation. So Busy Not Bees must be shaking at the bees' knees. Okay, we've kept you on tenterhooks long enough. The exciting news. 3CR will provide a two-minute update, an update every 2 minutes, on the current status of the US, of the UN, of the US of the world, Big Supremo Donald Trump, or the PAWS, latest tariff threats, with timetables, change timetables, percentages, change percentages, targets, change targets, every 2 minutes, keeping us as up-to-date as possible. Reporting, for instance, because we haven't heard they've been lifted, the status of that huge tariff on those Antarctic penguins and seals who need to do a lot more grovelling and promise to purchase all their seafood from the US op, although their cause could be made easier if Donald simply declared all Antarctic seafood US op property, like he has declared the seabed, seafloor, all over the world, US on property. All 3CR programs will cross every 2 minutes for an up-to-date report, acknowledging, of course, that by the time we broadcast the report, it will almost certainly be out of date, but only by a minute or so. I hope you're as excited as we are, listener. Music shows may be restricted to repeat after repeat of the minute waltz, but it's worth it. To show how easily good, honest people can make a simple little error. Former caring business class party minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Julie Bash Up the Workers, for instance. Julie, apart from running her own consultancy, is also Chancellor of ANU, where they are slashing spending by sacking or, sorry, sadly having to let go staff and cut courses. ANU provides her with an office in a 20-storey tower. 20 storeys in Canberra, I hear. 20-story tower by the Swan River. Yeah, I know, that's the other side of the country, but Julie Chancellor's from there, and last year her little office cost the cash-strap union insignificant 800 grand. No, be fair, 790,000. Oh, and ANU copped up another 800,000 to renovate it before she moved in. And the small error? Well, Julie, we know in the past, defended honourable industries like asbestos and tobacco, and now her consultancy has lots of honourable fossils as clients. Well, documents dealing with share changes in her business show its address as... couldn't be, it can't be, but it is. The Swan River office paid for by cash-strapped ANU. Further, it is also listed as her residential address, but... no problems. One of her staff cleared it up. It was, yes, an error. Not an error, but again, no problems. ANU also provides her with two staff for a mere $257,500, who are both also employees of, we guessed it, her consultancy. But ANU assures us there is no conflict of interest. Oh, and a Perth-based ANU chancellor? Her travel bill was only $150,000. We are sure it's worth it. No doubt she's providing all sorts of advice on how ANU can save money. Wonder if in those photos of a younger Donald and misogynist sleaze Jeffrey Epstein, looking very pally, close buddies with his arm around a young woman, if Donald told Jeffrey he, Jeffrey, was a creep, or has he just realised Jeffrey was a creep as he learns what Jeffrey was really up to, about which Donald would not have had the slightest idea at the time. Anyway, now he's a creep, so there's no need to release the list of clients and associates which may or may not exist, although can't help wondering why Donald is so opposed to the list being made public. Surely not. The coalition as an opposition certainly lifts the standard of debate, doesn't it? Like its attack on Big Supremo Anthony Albanese's visit to China. Indulgent, it screamed. There, philosophical debate run riot, including criticising his visit to see pandas, and I can't help myself in the very, very bad joke department. We assume that's pandemonium. At least the coalition and our minister for being offensive and train-killing Richard Malls the bad guys agree we must train-kill evil China sooner rather than later. With the US of pointing out that as Trubler was, he throws trillions to the US of merchants of death. Those trillions demand Trubler was, he join the US of in that train-killing. Although, thank goodness, Richard and the coalition don't need any encouragement in that area. Although we're not sure they've thought through how train killing with evil China might go. Ensuring we enjoy that warm, cosy feeling of safety, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute reported merchants of death expenditure rose 9.4% in the year to 4.1 trillion, real figure, 4.1 trillion worldwide. This peacenik mob made ludicrous claims like the massive increase on things that kill was affecting social programs that don't kill, guns or butter, it said, which could affect societies for years. How negative. Thankfully, the positive was put by a filthy rich asset management corporate hoping Donald can turn NATO from a cozy World War II relic into a 21st century war economy alliance. Let's hope so. What a thrilling thought. Thrilling future for the planet, a 21st century war economy, which we thought we already had. Obviously, that 4.1 trillion isn't nearly enough. Finally, wonder what the Palestinian non-land, non-people being slaughtered, destructured, and genocided think of that. Good afternoon.
The Victorian state government is planning repressive new laws to restrict protest, including bans on protective masks and lock-on devices, increased police search powers, restrictions on symbols of resistance such as flags, and creation of so-called safe zones around religious buildings, putting significant areas of the CBD off limits. We must say no to this attack on democracy. Protest is a fundamental human right. Join the fight to defend it at a mass rally hosted by Defend Dissent Coalition on Tuesday, 12th of August, 5:30 p.m. at Parliament House. Defend Dissent Coalition is a 3CR supporter.
In mid-May, a coalition of military veterans, religious and humanitarian organisations began a 40-day Veterans and Allied Fast for Gaza, with a news conference at 10 a.m. at the Isaiah Wall near the United Nations headquarters in New York City, and they moved to the US mission to the UN where the fast was conducted. The demands of the fast were full humanitarian aid for Gaza under UN authority and two, no more US weapons to Israel. Today I'm speaking with one of the fasters, Mike Ferner, former National Director of Veterans for Peace, Navy Corpsman from 1969 to 1973, and a member of the Toledo City Council from 1989 to 1993. I asked Mike first about his early life in Toledo, Ohio, and how his life changed when he joined the Navy as a corpsman and saw the results of war.
I might have had a quiet family life. I would have been bored to tears, probably. So I can't say that I regret the life choices I've made, because I really think the kind of life that I've lived and the kind of work that I'm doing is important to do. And I'm happy to be doing it. And I've met some of the best people I've ever met in my life doing this kind of work. So it's been a frustrating but joyful experience.
Can you talk about the veterans that you treated?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, they came back from Vietnam in pieces. I worked on a psychiatric ward, and I worked on a neurosurgery ward where guys had gotten spinal injuries and were never going to walk again and going to be flat on their backs in bed the rest of their lives, and you know, just all kinds of injuries. And we'd go to the chow hall and get our meals, and the walking wounded and the wheelchair bound would be lined up all over the place. So it was, a crash course on what war does. And before that time, I had no idea. I was young and stupid and didn't know what was going on in the world. I joined the military before I got out of high school even, so my eyes got opened to a lot, and I learned a lot while I was in there, and realized that our government lies on a pretty regular basis, and that we can't be taking for granted the stuff that we're taught in school.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. I think, you know, like most people in the U.S., raised on the myth of America that we're always on the side of the angels, and the angels are always on our side, and everything we do must be for the right reasons. And, you know, it's a lot of bunk. And we're told this, and unfortunately, too many people in the country believe it. And that's how, you know, the vast majority of children get raised. That's how I was raised, that what your country is doing is for the best, and you should appreciate that and support it. So, you know, when you find out that that's not the case, it's unsettling, to say the least. And it makes you do some serious thinking about what you're going to do with your life. So that's the biggest lesson I got out of being in the Navy as a young man.
And how long did you stay in the Navy, and what did you do after?
Well, I enlisted for 4 years, and I must have been in the slow reading club, because it took me a little over 3 years to understand that I needed to get out as a conscientious objector, because I just didn't want to participate in the war machine anymore. And after I found out what we were really doing in Vietnam and the evil that was being perpetrated on those people. So, I got out a little over 3 years out of a 4-year enlistment. And I was pretty unsettled for a few years. I wound up getting divorced. My wife and I at the time had a baby girl, and within a couple of years I was divorced and kind of really at loose ends. So that's what I experienced right after I got out. One thing that I experienced that I really enjoyed was working with the peace movement. The Navy sent me out to California, to the San Francisco Bay Area, to an aircraft carrier after I had been at the Navy hospital for a couple of years. So I got to meet people in Berkeley and Oakland and San Francisco who were involved in the peace movement, and I had never met people like that before, and I really enjoyed meeting them and realized that we were kindred spirits. I would have actually would have liked to have stayed out there, but my wife at the time was really anxious to get back to rural Ohio, where we were both from. Interesting, my daughter a couple of years ago said, you know, I was a baby out in California, and I just realized I could have grown up in California. And I just looked at her and smiled, and I said, talk to your mother about that one. So, like a lot of young couples, and, you know, especially when somebody's getting out of the military, everything is just topsy-turvy.
Well, where did that introduction to the peace movement take you?
Well, it took me to a place that I felt was genuine and real and humane and compassionate and fun and joyful. These were people that, like I said, I had never met people like that before, and I just found them delightful human beings. And I liked working with them, and I learned a lot about politics and about organizing, and I just had a great time. You know, people in the peace movement don't make any money doing that, and that's a problem when you've got a family, but I really enjoyed the movement work that I did. And it kind of set me on a course that I've stayed on, I guess, the rest of my life, because I moved back to Ohio and got divorced not too long after that. But I was always interested in the left movement, organizing. I was a union organizer for a few years, and that was one of the few times that I actually could use my time and skills and get paid for it. So I enjoyed that. But I was always involved with the environmental movement or the peace movement or racial justice or something. You know, it just seemed like there were so many people and so many issues that were clearly unjust. So many, let me try wording that one a little better. It seemed like there were so many people who were always victims of injustice and so many issues that showed how unjust the system is. It was easy for me to kind of stay in the fight, I guess we put it.
Were there a lot of people feeling the same way as you? Because I know even here in Australia, lots of people are so busy with their lives and they don't have time or the inclination to think about other things. Where did it take you, all that thinking? Did you join local politics? Did you get out on the streets? How did you sort of educate other people to the way you were thinking?
Yeah, I was on the streets quite a bit, protesting environmental dangers and labor concerns and peace and justice sorts of things. There were always those kinds of things going on. So, yeah, I was active at the grassroots level, and every once in a while I got to work for an organization as a staff person. So other than that, in between, I had a pretty modest life. You know, I really learned how to get by on next to nothing, and because I was most interested in movement politics and organizing and fighting a system, and those are the sorts of things that unless you're independently wealthy, you don't make any money at. So you know, that's how I spent my time. I would get a paid job when I had to and do that for a while, and then I'd get back into the movement. So that's kind of how my life went for a good number of years.
Well, fast forward to the preparations by the United States for the Iraq War. Was that when you met Kathy Kelly and other people such as Kathy?
Yes, that was. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 1991, you probably know Kathy was in Iraq during that period, and I was on Toledo City Council at that time. And I was on for two terms as an independent. And in 1991, when it looked like the U.S. was going to invade Kuwait and Iraq, I was very happy to be an elected official, even at just a local level, and to use that platform to be able to speak out against another war. And so I sponsored a resolution in Toledo City Council, like people did in city councils across the country. And we voted to tell Congress not to go to war. And obviously it didn't do any good, because we don't really run our own government here. But in the lead up to the 2003 invasion, I was so frustrated, because you could see there was a probable war on the horizon. And I was just not going to be happy holding a sign on a street corner. I had to do something more. And a friend of mine told me about Kathy and the Voices in the Wilderness at the time, and how they had been going to Iraq for several years to purposely violate the U.S. sanctions against Iraq, and that they were going to be going another time. This was in January of 2003. So by the time I reached them and got a chance to explain who I was and what I was doing, it was February of 2003. And so I went over there that month and stayed until March. And a couple of weeks after I came back was the U.S. invasion, where Kathy and a number of other people stayed in Baghdad during that whole thing.
What was it like for you to go to Baghdad at that time? That would have been your first trip overseas, and you're going into a country where you know that your country was preparing to perhaps obliterate, bomb. What was that like?
Well, in 1987, I had gone to three countries in Central America with Veterans for Peace. We went to Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua.
Right.
And we spent just a couple weeks. It wasn't a long trip, but we were there for a couple weeks and got a chance to meet with a good number of people and understand what the U.S. was doing. That's when the U.S. government was funding the Contras, and we were busy killing people who were fighting for land reform and some amount of economic justice. And so I had seen developing country, a third world country that we were oppressing firsthand. And so I had that experience before I went to Iraq in 2003. But it was just amazing to go there and see the spirit that people had. You know, I mean, it to me, and I'm sure to them, it must have felt like the bombs were going to start falling out of the sky any minute. I got there at the beginning of February, and the invasion happened the third week in March. So it was just not long at all before the U.S. did the shock and awe madness. So people were going about their lives and getting married and, you know, having birthday parties and just living normal lives. And the other thing that amazed me was how welcoming people were when we met and they found out I was from the United States. I mean, they had been under our sanctions for almost a decade, and their economy was in tatters because of that, and it caused great suffering. And yet they were still very welcoming and open. It was astonishing to me to be in a place where our government had spent years and billions of dollars trying to ruin their economy and make life miserable for them.
And yet we were treated as guests all the time, universally. So it was a real eye-opener for me to be in that situation. And then I went back. I was there for about a month, and then the following year, January of 2004, I went back for 2 months, and that was on my own, and traveled around quite a bit and did some writing and met lots of people in many different situations and got to have a better understanding of what life was like after the United States gets done destroying your society and your economy.
And how were the people coping at that time with life?
Well, you know, as best as people can in those situations. By the beginning of 2004, there were some people who had found a way to make money on the chaos and the black market, and so there were, it always happens, there were some people who were doing okay, but the big majority of people were, you know, found their life in pieces. You know, family members had been killed or wounded, and the whole society was turned upside down because, just as an example, after the American troops got into Baghdad, the only two government ministries that we guarded were the oil ministry and the interior ministry, which interior means police and security. And so those two places were guarded heavily, and their records were maintained and all of that. But everything else, you know, people's homeowner property records, you know, your medical certificates, all of those buildings that housed all of that information were getting ransacked. And, you know, people, it was just chaos. People were either bombed out of their homes or had moved out of their homes for safety, and somebody else had moved in and nobody could prove who owned the place. And I mean, just, it was just an incredible mess and stressful. And, you know, I'm sure, I don't have the numbers in my head, that's something Kathy was always better at, but, you know, we caused the death of over a million people there. And so it was extremely stressful and difficult, but people have a will to live and you know, manage to stay alive in the most awful conditions, and they did there in Iraq. And people were still pretty nice to a Westerner, but I stayed there for 2 months in January and February of 2004. And towards the end of my time there, that time, I could tell that people were getting quite angry with Americans. A lot of people were glad that Saddam Hussein was gone, but their economy and the society had been turned upside down, and violence was starting to pop up everywhere, and they wanted us gone. And, of course, we didn't go. The military stayed there for years. Believe it or not, people resent that. So it was not quite as welcoming as it was the previous year.
I'd imagine when you got home, you worked out ways that you were going to relay to the people in America what their government was actually doing. What did you do when you got back?
Well, I had taken a lot of pictures, and I do some writing. So I wrote some essays for online magazines and had a slideshow of the photographs, and I did some speaking, mostly in this area around Toledo, and quite a few places, actually, at churches and community groups, and people were interested to hear what I had learned. I would be showing the pictures of people that I took while I was there, and almost invariably, before the program was over, someone would say, well, those people are just like us. And at the first few times I heard that, I got really upset. And I wanted to say, well, where the hell did you think I went? Mars? You know, of course they're just like us. They're human beings. But it dawned on me that American society is so insulated and so steeped in this American exceptionalism about how we're the best in everything that even people who basically are decent people with good hearts are so ignorant about what life is like in the rest of the world. And so it was a real eye-opener to me to understand that being able to explain to people how we're the same was progress. I would have thought that was something everybody was already aware of, but apparently not.
Were you a member of Veterans for Peace at that time?
Yes, I joined Veterans for Peace the year it got started in 1985. When I was in Iraq with Kathy, I had my Veterans for Peace cap on, and I got to meet a couple of people who were U.S. veterans who were working for the news media there, and that was pretty interesting. My role when I was there prior to the U.S. invasion in 2003 with Kathy, my role was to write news releases and distribute them to the news outlets so that the Voices in the Wilderness group would do an action. We would have a banner, let's say, that we would hold at an electric plant or a water treatment plant that said George Bush to bomb this facility is a violation of the Geneva Convention. And so we would go and do that action, and I would do the news release for it. And we would have a dozen, 15, 20 reporters cover it, but never once a U.S. news outlet, never once. And in that month, 4 or 5 weeks that I was there prior to the 2003 invasion, we did at least 4, maybe 5 of those kinds of actions, and I did the news releases for them. We never got any U.S. media coverage. In fact, one time I was walking through the Ministry of Information, which is a 2 or 3 story building that housed all of the reporters from around the world, except for a few U.S. You know, big networks of the New York Times. They had their hotel suites, but the vast majority of the reporters were in the Ministry of Information. And so I would, you know, write the news release and type it up and copy it and go around the Ministry of Information and say, you know, we're going to be doing this news conference tomorrow, and here's the news release on it. Well, one day I was doing that, and this guy saw my Veterans for Peace cap, and he said, "Oh, hey, over there." And I sounded like an American voice, and I turned around, and the guy was a producer for one of the U.S. networks. I can't remember which one, ABC or CBS or something. And he said, "I'm over here, I'm producing the morning show for Harry Smith or whoever, and would you like to be on it tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, sure." So the next day, I showed up at the appointed place at the appointed hour. And he stuck his head out of the little broadcast shack that the network had on the roof of the Ministry of Information. And he said, "Oh, I'm really sorry." He said, we just announced the nominees for the Academy Awards, and we're going to have to bump you." Yeah. So I just looked at it, and I said, "Well, never let it be said that a war would get in the way of the Academy Awards ceremony." And, you know, that's how it went. And that's why people in this country don't know what the hell's going on.
Nevertheless, did you get arrested at any time for your activities?
Well, not over there, but no. a good number of times over here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just arrested, probably a couple of times with Kathy, but frequently with members of Veterans for Peace. And just got arrested about a little over a week ago in New York at the United Nations, where Kathy joined us at a fast to protest what was going on in Gaza. But it was a 40-day fast, and she went about 10 days, and her health really gave out. And I went 21 days and wound up in the hospital, and the rest of the Veterans for Peace members there, and a number of local New York people that with Jews for Peace and other different groups were participating in the fast. And they carried out the whole 40 days. And at the end of that was June 30th. And one of the things that we did was have an action at the had a die-in and blocked the streets at Israeli mission to the UN, and at the U.S. mission to the UN, where we had been vigiling every day during the fast, I had a bucket of cow's blood and threw it on the window and got arrested for that one. So the hearing's coming up next month sometime.
What does a fast for 40 days mean for you?
Well, that was the second fast of that sort that I did. The first one was with Kathy at her invitation back in 2006 to protest the war in Iraq. And that was 35 days with just water and tea. It was the first time I'd ever done anything like that, so it was a pretty transformational experience. It was very kind of otherworldly to be in that state of not eating for 35 days. This one, we decided to do it for 40 days, and we decided to limit ourselves to 250 calories, which was about what the people in Gaza were supposedly getting at that time, so that we could say that, you know, we were doing something that was relatively similar to the experience in Gaza. I found it more difficult, frankly, because we had to figure out what we were going to eat for 250 calories and what time of the day, and we were thinking about food quite a bit, where before, when we weren't eating at all, it was just a question of, well, you know, I'm not eating, so make sure I drink enough water, and you get through it. But this last one was, the most recent one, was a little more difficult because, like I said, we were thinking of food and, you know, how we're going to deal with 250 calories a day. But the really wonderful part of it was the experience that the camaraderie and the spirit of the sense of community that we felt, those of us in New York who were fasting, and there were, you know, Kathy and some of the members of Veterans for Peace and Jewish Voices for Peace and so forth, that we got to know each other better. And we were part of a very serious effort to call attention to the genocide. And it felt like we were doing something significant for a change. And so we were joined by about 800 people around the country who participated in the fast in some way or another, including at least one person, I'm not sure how many, in Australia that Kathy had previously already met. And I've drawn a blank on the gentleman's name, but
Alan Clayton.
Right, right. But there were people in that contacted us from South Africa, from Hong Kong, from Ireland, from Germany, from Canada, who said that they were just as distraught as we were about what was going on, and they appreciated and welcomed the opportunity to participate in something that felt a little more meaningful, which was the reason that we wanted to do this.
I'd imagine that being an advocate for Palestine has been part of your life for many, many years. And you talk about worrying how you're going to get to the 250 calories. We can't imagine what it must be like for the people of Palestine who don't have to pick and choose from what food they're going to eat. They just don't have any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we were very clear to put it in that context whenever we talked to people about it. Unfortunately, we didn't get a chance to talk to any U.S. reporters except for Democracy Now! And Pacifica radio station out of New York. We did get interviewed by a lot of local radio stations and podcasts around the country, but, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Reuters and AFP and everybody else stayed far away. So we never got a chance to explain it to them, but we were always very purposeful in saying that we're doing this fast and it's uncomfortable, it's an inconvenience, hungry all the time, but we have good water to drink and we have a safe place to go to bed at night, and we don't have to worry about having to get up and walk for 2 hours to try to find something to eat or drink. And worry about being killed and our children killed and on and on and on. That's what was going on with the people in Gaza. And I got very sick. I almost died. The fast was not a good thing for me to do medically because I'm being treated for cancer. And combined with, as my wife was quick to tell me, the first time I did the fast with Kathy was 20 years ago. And I was a little younger then. And my electrolytes crashed. And I didn't realize what a dangerous thing that could be, and I wound up in the hospital for 6 days. You know, but if I'd have been in Gaza, I'd have, you know, I would have just died like so many people are doing. You know, when their electrolytes crash or their, you know, the starvation gets to the point where it affects their health in a really major way, they don't have the luxury of checking into a hospital for 6 days. You know, they're dead. That's it. They don't get a chance to just quit that existence and start to eat and drink properly. They can't. So they get very, very sick and they die. And that's part of what we were trying to explain to people was, you know, we're doing this, but, you know, it's not anything like the people are experiencing Gaza.
Finally, Mike, the demands of the fast were full humanitarian aid to Gaza under UN authority and no more US weapons to Israel. Are we any closer?
Probably not. You know, there's more people aware. There's some international, some countries are making some noise, the Hague group and other formulations of international groups making some noise about, you know, really trying to do something concrete. But you know, quite frankly, the people who have the power to stop this really don't give a damn. Some people are making a whole lot of money on it. Other people are trying to figure out ways where they'll be able to make money on it somehow down the road if they're not a weapons maker right now and making money. The forces of greed and corruption and evil are holding sway. And like I said earlier, you know, we don't run our government here. It's run by corporations that make money on death. You know, even though I think most of the people here in this country and around the world, if you really got into a conversation with them and asked them, they would appreciate the same human values as, you know, the vast majority of people do, but we don't control our government here. And it just is off on a psychotic tear. A very, very troubling and tragic and sad situation.
We all do our bit, but it's not quite enough. But I thank you so much for today, Mike.
Okay. Well, I sure appreciate you getting in touch with me.
I've been speaking with Mike Furno at his home in Toledo, Ohio. And Mike is a former National Director of Veterans for Peace.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
On the program last week, journalist with Ireland's Business, Nick McCullen, spoke about the meeting in Paris where the French president met with New Caledonian elected officials and state representatives to discuss an agreement aimed at granting the island more autonomy. The meeting went for over a week and resulted in the French Prime Minister Macron announcing that it was a historic agreement proposing a state within a state. When I spoke to Nick again, I asked him if this meeting went for a long time.
The talks were quite drawn out. President Macron had invited everyone to Paris starting on the 2nd of July, as well as the political leaders from six different parliamentary groups. There was also a bevy of business leaders, community leaders, some customary leaders brought to Paris for a parallel meeting on economic and social issues. The talks were on and off over a week, and indeed they almost broke down. You know, there's a fundamental difference of opinion between the independence movement, who obviously want a political independence and sovereignty for New Caledonia, and the so-called loyalist anti-independence parties who want to stay within France. And to square that circle has been very difficult. Indeed, it was only after days and days of talks where some issues were agreed, but those fundamental questions about sovereignty were still in dispute. FLNKS leadership held a video conference with members of the political bureau of the independence movement back in Noumea. It looked like the talks were about to collapse, but finally people were persuaded that the compromises needed to be made, and the balance of forces was not great. And so the deal was signed very early on the morning of the 12th of July.
That's the trouble, though, with compromises, isn't it, Nick? People aren't happy with a compromise.
And that's certainly the case with this agreement known as the Bougival Accord. After it was in the town of Bougival, which is just on the outskirts of Paris, that people were locked away in a hotel for this period. It's very clear that a lot of people are angry back in New Caledonia about the various compromises that were made by political leaders, both supporters and opponents of independence. For example, one of the leading anti-independence people, the second vice president of the southern province, very conservative, indeed reactionary guy called Philippe Blaise, has come out denouncing the signature of the agreement by the key loyalist leaders. At the same time, the independence movement, there's been a lot of flack for the key negotiators from both Union Caledonienne and Palika, the feeling that the compromises that they made to strike a deal really set back rather than improve the move to independence. There's a lot in the agreement that will raise real questions on both sides. The other point, though, to stress is this is not signed, sealed and delivered. There is a political agreement, and leaders pledged that they'd come back to try and sell it to their party members, to their electoral constituency. But there's a whole series of steps that have to be taken to translate it into law. And that's going to take months and months. And the tight timetable that's been set for that, it's not, it could be disrupted by a whole range of things unrelated to New Caledonia, particularly the political chaos in France, where the Conservative government led by Prime Minister François Bayrou might collapse in a no-confidence motion in the next few months. Lots of moving parts in this. And I think it's important to say, although the headline said this is an historic agreement, everyone's agreed on this, that's not true. There are fundamental debates going on within New Caledonia. It has to be passed through the French Parliament, National Assembly and Senate in Paris, sometime possibly in September, October. And it has to go to a referendum in New Caledonia for New Caledonians to vote whether they accept or reject this political deal. So let's wait and see. There's a lot still going to happen in coming weeks and months.
And what are the main issues now?
There are a few stumbling blocks within it. For the independence supporters and people I've spoken to and certainly watching on social media and reading press communiques and so on, there's a lot of concern about it. The fundamental issue about full and sovereign political independence has been deferred once again. This is not an independence agreement immediately. Similarly, there's provisions in the agreement that strengthen the power of the southern province. The three provinces in New Caledonia, the two in the rural areas and the outlying islands, the Loyalty Islands, the Northerners province, are both connect majority population and have been run by the independence movement for the last 25, 30 years. The southern province, however, is a bastion of the so-called loyalist or anti-independence parties. And what we see in this agreement is a series of measures that strengthen the administrative and financial powers of the southern province. Indeed, there's a proposal to change and increase the number of seats in the Congress, the local parliament of New Caledonia, that would add some seats for the southern province, which has got a larger population, take away seats, particularly from the Loyalty Islands. So that sort of angered people. Most importantly, one of the big issues that triggered the conflict last year was a debate about changing voting rights for New Caledonia's local political institutions, the three provincial assemblies, the Congress. There's a restricted electorate of so-called New Caledonian citizens. That, you know, has been argued about for 20 years, about how do you expand or reduce the number of people who could vote locally. And this agreement expands the numbers of people by saying that New Caledonian-born citizens can vote, and if you're resident for 15 years or more continuously in New Caledonia. Now, that will add a number of people, thousands of people, to the voting rolls, and people may remember that this was one of the central issues that triggered the violent conflicts last year, the riots and protests that pitted Kanak activists against French police. I think many young activists, and some I've spoken to, are concerned that, you know, they fought on the barricades last year, and yet this change has come through as part of this overall agreement.
Well, not only fought on the barricades, but died.
That's right. Of 14 people who died last year, 11 were Kanak, particularly young Kanak. And, you know, more than that, you know, there were more than 2,600 arrests, most of them protesters, last year. And so people are still living with, you know, court cases and so on that are still playing out even months after the end of the clashes. And people's, you know, lives are pretty tough. I was there a month or so ago and in New Caledonia. And, you know, the economy's not good. The nickel industry's been in trouble for a couple of years. Last year, one in six people lost their jobs in the private sector. So when you talk to trade unions there, you know, people are just doing it tough. A lot of unemployment, a lot of people who've done stuff. And friends told me that, you know, there's a lot of burglaries and things. And it's not just petty delinquents, but it's young people breaking in to steal food from houses. So times are tough. And the trauma and legacy of 6 months of conflict in 2024 are still playing out in New Caledonia. I think it's worth stressing, though, that on the other side, there's anger. As I mentioned, Philippe Blaise and other loyalists, you read the French media, French conservatives, politicians and pundits are really angry about this deal because it talks about significant constitutional changes. The proposal is that there be a state of New Caledonia, like a nation state of New Caledonia within the French Republic, and that the existing New Caledonian citizenship, which has existed since the Noumea Accord was signed more than 25 years ago, that be transformed into a New Caledonian nationality alongside the French nationality. So people would have both French and New Caledonian nationality. Now that raises a whole series of constitutional questions. This won't be defined for more than a year until after the next elections. But the contours of the state, this idea of it being a state, would allow for international recognition, for example. And for some French conservatives, this is a major philosophical and legal challenge to the notion that France is one indivisible republic, as the constitution, the French constitution says. You know, France is France. And to have the notion of a state within a state, look, I don't know how this is going to play out, and indeed many independence people think that there are some quite restrictive qualifications on whether this state would ever come into existence. It has to pass through major changes in the Congress, and I won't go into all the details, but this is not something that's going to happen tomorrow, in spite of what the headlines suggest, that this agreement creates a new state. It's a long way down the track. But many French conservatives are worried about a slippery slope, that if you start talking about New Caledonia as a state rather than just as a territory of France, that's a really fundamental philosophical and ultimately political challenge to the people who says that this is France in the South Pacific. It's not. Independence people have always said it's a colony of France, administered by France, but that it's not part of France. Conservatives, although they see this potential change hemmed in by all sorts of rules and restrictions that may make it very unlikely, they worry that this will open the floodgates. And certainly people in other places in the French Empire, French Polynesia or Guadeloupe and other parts of other French colonies are watching all of this with great attention and figuring, hey, if New Caledonia can be a state within a state, why are we still a territory?
Where does it leave the issue of decolonisation?
Well, some people I've spoken to in the independence movement are very concerned that this basically locks the decolonization process up in French constitutional law, you know, the fundamental law that would bring this political agreement into law has to be passed by the French Parliament, enshrined in the French Constitution. And there's a concern from some that this will take away from broader United Nations principles of decolonization. The key negotiators for the independence movement disagree. They put out a statement saying this is a major step forward, reaffirming the right to self-determination, the right to an independent nation. It's going to take a long time to play out. There's going to be a lot of argy-bargy in the coming weeks as people debate this. Most people I know and spoken to over the last week haven't really got the detail of the agreement. It hasn't been, and so there's going to be a whole political education process and certainly lots of debate within New Caledonia. The French Parliament is due to develop what's called a fundamental law, a basic law, to translate this political agreement into law. And then it can be enshrined in the French Constitution to replace the Lumière Accord. But all of this is supposed to happen in September, October, but that's the very time that France will be going through its budgetary debates. And unrelated to New Caledonia, there are moves to bring down the Bayrou government. The Rassemblement National Party, the extreme right party led by Marine Le Pen, is angry with President Macron and his government. The chance of Bayrou losing power in a no-confidence motion is not zero. The very tight timetable set by the French to get all this stuff through for New Caledonia is going to be thrown up in the air if there's no government for a period, even if it's just for weeks. It sets back the timetable if they want to get stuff through France this year and then have a referendum next February. It's not that far away, and there's a whole lot of things that have to be done legally and constitutionally to make all this happen. So I think the key message is the headlines, you know, that France and New Caledonia have signed an agreement to create a state. Well, yeah, they've signed the agreement, but it's not locked in yet. And I think this is going to continue for some months.
Two comments. Will this allow Kanaks and others in New Caledonia to move forward rather than be divided? And the other is, last year, the young were willing to die for Kanaki.
Just over the last week or so, I think there's quite mixed reactions within New Caledonia. On the one hand, many business people and community leaders are pleased that finally, after literally years of talks and negotiations, that political leaders have forged a consensus. And when you get into the, you know, it's a 13-page document, when you get into the detail, there are a number of issues where there are agreement about some administrative reforms in New Caledonia, about the priority around elections and the economy and so on. So there are certainly areas of convergence, public statements from, say, the key business community leaders, they welcome the agreement. But there's also a lot of grumbling in the ranks on both sides, independent supporters and opponents. And I think that's going to take some time to play out. That mixed reaction will, I think, get more complex as people actually read and digest the fine point and qualifications. There's a couple of really major steps forward that create openings for a move to continue to decolonization. One of them, for example, under the agreement, France will continue to control some of the so-called sovereign powers over courts and policing, over the military, over the currency, you know, maintaining the French Pacific franc. But the power over foreign affairs is going to be vested with the government of New Caledonia if all of this passes into law. Now, to have a pro-independence president with the power for foreign affairs is going to really transform issues. That power is supposed to be wielded taking account of the interests of France. But there are a number of issues where New Caledonian visions of the world really fundamentally are different to French visions of the world. You think of everything from issues around nuclear weapons to self-determination and solidarity with West Papua to maritime boundaries to trade issues. Vanuatu and New Caledonia under the previous independence president Louis Mapu signed a trade deal that has been stymied and blocked by French officials and diplomats. If New Caledonia runs foreign affairs to a certain extent, that could potentially create all sorts of new areas for dispute, but also advancement. Because ultimately, New Caledonians, obviously, especially the Indigenous Kanak and the independence movement, want to integrate with their neighbours, with Australia, with New Zealand, particularly with neighbouring Melanesian countries, to work together on issues of common concern. France is hanging on by the fingernails as a colonial power, a quarter of the way through the 21st century, to say this is still France. And so when you look at this step about a state within a state, it's really complex. It's certainly not happened yet. It's got a long way to go before it's implemented. But for many people, this is going to be a real challenge to the notion that this is just a little bit of France in the South Pacific. It's a significant philosophical change. How it plays out politically, well, the struggle goes on.
Much to talk about in the coming months, Nick.
Indeed, this ain't over yet. Thanks as always, Jen.
And many thanks once again to journalist with Ireland's Business, Nick McClellan.
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favourite radio program is produced? On Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2025. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR, Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July. See you then.
It's been many years since my first interview about the push for deep sea mining. Must be over 10 years now, with activists from the Australian NGO Deep Sea Mining Campaign. And it would appear that the push for offshore mining is really hotting up, with the issue being discussed this year at the third UN Oceans Conference and the second part of the 30th session of the International Seabed Authority. To explain further, I spoke with James Hitter, Communications and Advocacy Coordinator with Deep Sea Mining Campaign. James, it's been a long time for me. How long has deep sea mining been on your mind?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I went to Greenpeace, which is where my journey started with deep sea mining, I initially was looking for a campaigning issue that I could work on that allowed me to work with Indigenous peoples, with the ocean, and had some really strong crossover there. So deep sea mining was the right thing for me at that time. What I realized actually, though, was that I'd been, it sort of popped up in my Facebook memories one day, that I'd been talking about deep sea mining for about 7 years before that. So even without realizing it, without thinking of it as one of my core issues, it obviously really spoke to my values, and I'd been, yeah, talking about the issue for quite a while.
It seems to have hit the headlines in the last little while. Why is that?
In campaigning, we recognise that issues build up over time and they hit an inflection point where everything just starts hammering. What's been really interesting is with Donald Trump getting in on the mix and with deep sea mining, is that we've just seen it explode all across the world. You know, we've been trying to get it in media and all of a sudden it's really interesting for people. So, you know, I think we're at that inflection point where there's lots happening and it's really newsworthy and reportable now.
What does Trump want to do? Who is he working with?
Trump and Gerard Barron from the metals company seem to be buddies at the moment. Trump has issued executive orders that essentially enable the industry and really push it forward. The metals company and the Trump administration worked together to essentially bypass the International Seabed Authority and the multilateral approach, which is, you know, the best practice in the international waters. So now they're using US domestic law, which predates UNCLOS, to try and get around the rules and regulations that protect the deep ocean.
What's the plan?
Essentially, it's ignoring the multilateral approach. It's saying to the ISA, don't worry, we're not going to respect your authority over international waters, and which is bolstered by the fact that the US hasn't signed on to nor ratified UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. So essentially, while the US sits in that space as an observer, you know, they don't vote, they don't have any say, and they do what they want in international waters. It's typical US politics.
Just look, going back over this year, apart from what Trump's up to, there's been the Third Oceans Conference, and what deep sea mining did, how important was that at that conference?
Yeah, the United Nations Oceans Conference is a really broad thing, right? There are so many oceans issues that people are working on across the board, but deep sea mining has always formed a really significant moment within that space. This time what we saw was that deep sea mining was the most significant moment, I think. It was being spoken about right across the board, and there was zones specifically set aside for deep sea mining. So we saw France, for example, the president stand up and very vocally call for a ban on deep sea mining, which was fantastic. And we're seeing more and more countries come out and say, look, we're not going to stand for deep sea mining and jump on board for that moratorium call at moments like the United Nations Oceans Conference, which is fantastic.
And what did it resolve at the end of the conference?
You're probably teasing out my disdain for these big conferences.
No, you can explain why you have such a disdain then.
Well, I tend to not attend these things myself, because we can talk and we can talk and we can talk, but what results actually come from those conversations? And while it's a really good opportunity for really strong individuals championing these issues to connect and cross-pollinate, the United Nations Oceans Conference, I think, doesn't often result in very much of its own accord. What I do see coming out of it, though, is countries like France and whatnot tend to make these announcements supporting big moments and big movements like banning deep sea mining at these events. So that's probably the best thing that we got out of it, really.
Well, are you any happier with the ISA meetings, the International Seabed Authority meetings?
Well, we've really seen a shift in the International Seabed Authority over time. So we've got a new Secretary General in the ISA, Leticia Carvalho. Isn't by any means an ally of the movement to stop deep sea mining. She does believe in the ISA's dual mandate, which is to protect the ocean and enable deep sea mining. But what we're seeing is that the industry capture is just not there anymore. So the previous Secretary General attended deep sea mining companies' events and unveiled their new machines and was really, in their pockets, hand in hand. But this Secretary General is just not comfortable with the rush to mine the deep ocean. So she's taking a very cautious approach. I wouldn't say, it's not precaution as such, which would be a moratorium. But it's a far more thorough and appropriate approach to the industry.
Where do you expect this one is going to end up, this meeting?
It's hard to tell, but the big thing that we want to happen at every ISA meeting is, and we've frequently called for this over the years, so we're hoping we might get there this time, is general policy. So the general policy is what, you can describe as a moratorium. It's the countries across the board sitting down together and agreeing that now is not the time to go ahead, that a lot more needs to happen before we could ever say that this might be safe, sustainable industry, which we don't think it will ever. But, it's about providing a pause to gather the data, figure things out, and take a cautious approach toward that. So a moratorium on deep sea mining would be the ideal. Not going ahead with deep sea mining right now is the good enough that we expect.
But there's been a fair bit of scientific data come out over the last years. Can you talk about that?
There's quite a lot happening. Unfortunately, one of the biggest collectors of data is the metals company, and they often talk about this, but their data is not publicly accessible. So they put it in private, and that's something that we've constantly called for. Calling for that information to be shared so that we can look at it and figure out if what their reckons are true. But they don't give us that opportunity, so we're not able to. On the other hand, a new company in the mix, Impossible Metals, is looking to mine in American Samoa via the US as well, which has a whole other background to it. But their claims of being the responsible alternative to the metals company are easily debunked. So what we did is used their more publicly accessible information, analyzed it, and put out a paper, a briefing paper, to explain why, you know, their tech might be new, but the harm that it causes is just the same.
Impossible Metals, that's a strange name to call a company.
It is, and our briefing paper sort of reflected that because, you know, it's Impossible Metals and that sort of right in the name. We just don't think that their dream of taking these metals and promising that their methods are more appropriate and sustainable, we just don't think that those promises are possible. So our briefing paper is titled Impossible Metals, Impossible Promises.
Well, let's focus, rather than the big organisations, on the movement around the world to stop this progress to deep sea mining, and your campaign here in Australia is part of that. What have you been doing the last while to promote your point of view?
It's been a very busy time. We're really looking forward. We've just completed a process to plan for the next couple of years, which we're really excited for. One thing we don't have a lot of time for, but we think is really important, is working on Australia's role in global negotiations. We've seen the Albanese government not really do very much. They've kind of sat on their hands. So we've sent letters to the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister and the Environment Minister. They just seem to come up with excuses. Often it's that our relationship with Nauru, who's one of the countries trying to go for deep sea mining, you know, that puts Australia in a precarious position. But we just don't think that's valid. So yesterday, we, alongside the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, Greenpeace Australia Pacific, and Surfrider Foundation Australia, sent a letter to those three, the Foreign Minister, Environment Minister, and the Prime Minister, urging them to pick a side, to show leadership. You know, the Bob Hawke government showed leadership in protecting Antarctica, and we wanted to put down our foot and say, look, now's the moment. There's an opportunity for historic leadership in the Albanese government. It would look like supporting a moratorium at the ISA and opposing rushing the mining code and upholding UNCLOS and that idea of multilateralism, not letting corporate companies push through and bypass international law. So we'll see if they end up doing anything with that.
How did the CSIRO get involved?
CSIRO is an interesting one because CSIRO and previously NIWA in New Zealand, which was the CSIRO equivalent, were in a weird relationship with the metals company. CSIRO formed a consortium of researchers working to develop models of research and trying to establish baselines on deep sea mining. But really, you know, all of that sort of technical blah blah isn't important. They were really helping to accelerate the industry, which I find really concerning, that our federal organization tasked with you know, protecting the environment and assessing the data was helping someone actively, you know, progress mining of international waters. But it was particularly interesting because the head of NIWA, Dr. Michael Clark, who is assisting the metals company with developing their environmental impact assessments, then goes on to submit those environmental impact assessments to himself, where he sits on the Legal and Technical Commission in the International Seabed Authority. So there are layers of really risky behaviour. Our recent correspondence with CSIRO was to say, look, where are you at? Their relationship is now ended. But our urge of the government in communications was to say, look, make sure that CSIRO never touches that again. Do not let them have a relationship with the metals company, a company that's looking to bypass and essentially break international law.
Let's look at the history of the metals company.
Absolutely. You know, Gerard Barron, the head of the metals company, is an Australian. You know, he lives supposedly in Brisbane. One year we even sent him a Christmas card saying, you know, Merry Christmas, please don't destroy the ocean. But he's got a particular history. So prior to the metals company, the company, it was called Deep Green, and they went through a merger process, which was flawed in and of itself. But Deep Green did all of the bad stuff at the beginning, and then they rebranded to try and, you know, leave that bad PR behind. But even before Deep Green, Gerard Barron was involved in Nautilus Minerals in Papua New Guinea, which ended up costing the Papua New Guinean government a huge amount of money and has now led to the Prime Minister, James Marape, commenting that deep sea mining is not acceptable in his country, and is, as it currently stands, there is a moratorium in place.
Has the PNG government been able to get that money back?
No, look, they did argue some technical points to say that they were party to the contracts rather than a partner, but that was unsuccessful. I don't have the figures in front of me, but the amount was a huge amount. I think it was close to or even above the health budget for Papua New Guinea. For a Pacific Island nation, that's a huge amount of money to lose thanks to a company like Nautilus Minerals. And, you know, now they're trying to go for it again, reinvigorating the Solwara 1 license. Still now, a new company, Deep Sea Mining Finance, which has ties to, you know, oligarchs from Russia, you know, they are trying to reinvigorate this license. And, you know, we spoke out about it recently at the Deep Sea Mining campaign, and were hit with a cease and desist to say, stop talking about it in this specific way. We said, look, prove it's not illegal mining and we'll stop calling it illegal mining. And they haven't really said much since.
Well, just how many companies are there around the world pushing for deep sea mining that you know of?
There are those really pushing for it right now. So you've got the metals company, Impossible Metals, Moana Minerals in the Cook Islands, which is more domestic mining, but still concerning. The metals company has several subsidiaries that work, which are essentially part of the metals company across the Pacific. And there are some companies sort of coming out in Japan and India as well. But really, you know, if even one of them gets the go-ahead, this is the same concern domestically in Aotearoa New Zealand as well. But if one of them gets the go-ahead, it opens the floodgates and they'll all start coming and they won't stop. It'll be the same as the oil and gas you know, boom way back when. And we have the opportunity to stop this industry before it starts, but that window is really rapidly closing. So, but we're saying to people now that we really need everyone to stand up and, you know, stand for the ocean, which doesn't have a voice of its own. And we need to be that voice, and it's really important. You know, if we think back to movements like Nuclear Free Independent Pacific and the Antarctic Treaties, we need that that level of momentum from the general public.
And just explain before we go any further, what are the worries about deep sea mining for people who might just be hearing this for the first time?
It's relatively straightforward. You know, if you think about a relatively pristine environment, one of the last frontiers on planet Earth, if you think about it, one of the most undisturbed environments, and essentially taking a bulldozer 24/7 across huge areas multiple times over with different companies in different places. And, you know, you dig up everything. And Impossible Metals and Gerard Barron, the metals company, like to frame the deep ocean as the abyssal plains. So, you know, if you picture in your head nothing for hundreds and hundreds of kilometers, the reality is vastly different. It's hugely biodiverse. The seabed itself has bacteria, it's a carbon sink. You know, all of these things are really important to the delicate ecosystems. And, you know, you take one part of that pyramid out and the pyramid topples. And so that's one of the major concerns, is that sheer biodiversity loss. So you grind all of the rocks and metals and everything up. It's loss of habitat. The nodules are one of the only hard surfaces for organisms down there to hold on to and anchor themselves, to breed, to eat, to rest. And then you've got the noise and light pollution. You've got the toxic plumes of pollution that are spewed out once, you know, the processing has been done on site. So there are huge issues. And one of the most contentious ones that are coming out at the moment and is still, you know, the science is being worked on is this idea of dark oxygen, where the polymetallic nodules have been found to be processing carbon dioxide and turning it back into oxygen, and that being a major reason the ocean might be able to provide every second breath we take. As you often hear, the forest gives you one breath and the ocean gives you the next, and that's where we get our breathable oxygen from. So there's multiple layers.
We're all aware of the issues of on-land mining, but when you talk like that, on-land mining looks a little bit like a pussycat.
Well, yeah, it's two very dangerous beasts, and the argument we often hear is, you want mining to happen in the Congo, then don't you, since you don't want deep sea mining. And my argument back to them is always the same. Not one single landmine will close thanks to the opening of mining in the deep ocean. Not a single mine. In fact, what will happen is the human rights abuses happening in places like the Congo, for example, will be exacerbated, because when you introduce a new supply, the global price of the metal will decrease, and therefore the individuals working, or I don't know if you can call it working, in places like the DRC, will likely be subject to worse human rights abuses because they have to work harder for less. That's the realities of the situation.
Well, just finally, James, you began by saying that you started your work to work with Indigenous peoples. What's your connection now with this work with Indigenous peoples in the Pacific particularly?
Look, I'm really honoured to have a significant part of my role be to assist a network of Indigenous people working across the Pacific on deep sea mining, aptly called the Pacific Network Against Deep Sea Mining. So, you know, we've got people like Uncle Solomon Ka'ohalahala from Hawaii, a former congressman working on the issue. We've got people from the Cook Islands, Tonga, Papua New Guinea, Fiji, all coming together to work on this issue. And part of my role is to help facilitate that organisation. But, you know, Pacific resistance has been really strong, in particular in New Ireland province and Papua New Guinea, where Jonathan Mesulam and the Alliance of Solwara Warriors, you know, they're just powering ahead with the proper process, you know, community consultation, taking this issue to the people where they are and in a way that they can understand, which is, you know, what I have to tell Western organizations over and over and over all the time. You know, they're doing it in the right way, and the people of the New Ireland province are really strongly opposed to deep sea mining, and I'm so proud of them for that. And, you know, that's where this campaign, our organization, Deep Sea Mining Campaign, but the idea of being anti-deep sea mining was born. So I have to give them props there.
And just finally, you've got a fairly extensive webpage for people to get more information.
Absolutely. So it's dsm-campaign.org. I personally look after the website. I've done a huge amount of work recently to make sure that it's accessible, it's easy to read, you can find the information you need. What we do at the moment is ask people to subscribe to our email newsletter. I'm trying to give people updates that are easy to read, actions that are easy to take on a regular but not offensively regular basis. So if you want to do something and you're hearing this and you think, you know, I need to put a little bit of my effort towards that, that's a really great way to do it, is to subscribe to that email newsletter and take small actions over time, which add up to building momentum to stop deep sea mining.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate talking to you.
I've been speaking with James Heater, who is the Communications and Advocacy Coordinator with Deep Sea Mining Campaign, and that webpage is dcm-campaign.org.
As the Taco Helm apocalypse approaches us with impending doom, it's time for the best alternative comedy debate in NAM.
Join us for the 21st annual Green Left Comedy Debate, where progressive comedians will debate whether or not billionaires should run the government.
Featuring your famous, award-winning comedian Tom Ballard as our MC, with the brilliant talents of Nikki Barry, Hellchild, Shirley Hood, Rose Callahan, Sarah Bartolo, and David Fowles.
It will be happening at Saturday, August 9th at the Brunswick Town Hall, with dinner and doors open at 6:30 p.m. with the show beginning at 8 p.m.
There'll be food, drinks and laughter, and special guest President Donald Dump leading the positive team. Take it away, Don.
It's going to be a big debate, a great debate, a beautiful debate. I thought of it, by the way.
And all proceeds to the event will go towards activist media Green Left. So come along and join us on Saturday, August the 9th at the Brunswick Town Hall. And book your tickets by going onto the Green Left website or visiting greenleft.org/events. Green Left is a 3CR supporter.
And to continue with the webinar of the Palestine Forum, featuring Palestinian activist Ahmed Alabadla, speaking with journalists Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aran. Ahmed begins by asking about the role of the Zionist lobby in the recent Australian elections on the Green vote.
First of all, this is a question of analysis. Today, my partner and I, Chris Nash, started looking at a few of these figures because the main thrust of the campaign was really to put the Greens last. That's the main thrust of the Minority Impact Coalition, which was one of the astroturfing groups. Then you had Advance, which poured millions of dollars into this over a period of months. And then you also had Better Australia. So all of this was directed to put the Greens last. So really, to assess the impact of it, you do have to look at the primary vote, but I mean, most of all, you've got to look at the preferences. I imagine that within the Greens, I assume that they would do analysis. But I find it really interesting the way that no one kind of wants to talk about astroturfing either before the election in the media, because it's very much portrayed as, you know, this is the battle between two parties, two leaders. We don't want to get too messy and go out there. And plus, it's because the astroturfing was Zionist, the media were unlikely to cover it anyway. After the election, I think everyone wants to put a good gloss on things, including the Greens, move on. But I personally think the analysis should be done, and I hope that maybe Michael West can publish something of this in the future. But I would say yes. I would say first of all, you have to look at the different booths, and you probably got to look at the Teals as well, because they're also very much targeting the Teals, Better Australia particularly. But if you look at Brisbane and you look at Melbourne, now obviously Adam Bandt in Melbourne, big loss for the Greens. To lose Adam Bandt was not expected and was very serious. He did take in some new parts that were meant to be more pro-liberal, and his primary vote did go down from an extraordinarily high 49%, like there's very few electorates that are these days majority, down to about 40. That was a drop in his primary vote. But even then, clearly on election night, he expected to get elected. As I said before, we're talking about numbers of different strategies, operating on social media, operating through mailboxes. If you have people saying, these people support terrorism, they are dangerous, they are liars, you have that repeatedly said. If you're a potential voter, swing from Labor to Greens to Labor, or alternatively, putting your preferences, and you've just got a leaflet. They always tell people on polling booths that a certain number of people do make up their minds at the last minute. If you've got someone giving you a leaflet, can certainly affect.
Who were these organisations?
Oh, well, Start Better Australia was one of them. And Minority Impact Coalition, which is sort of a front for the Queensland Jewish Collective, they operated well outside Queensland in this election. They became a national organisation, but they are literally a front for Queensland Jewish Collective. In the Melbourne anyway, you can see a very strong shift from preferences, Greens losing a share, a big share, maybe even worth 10% of the vote, share on the preferences, switching away from people giving their preferences to the Greens to Labor. Now, in Queensland also, I won't go into the figures, but I think is particularly in Griffith and in Brisbane, you can see the potential effect of it. But of course, it's always difficult to analyse it because someone could say, well, they didn't run a very good campaign, or they didn't do this, or something else happened. So, you know, it will always only be analysis pointing in a direction. But I think when you pour that amount of money in and you put out that amount of material, if we were to say it doesn't have an effect, that is almost like saying political communication doesn't have an effect. So it doesn't make sense, really, to say it doesn't have any impact.
Keen to get your thoughts on that, Yaakov. And if you could also shine some light on the Minority Impact Coalition, because that's particularly of importance given the current attack on Iran, because, you know, that included some Iranian elements here in Australia.
Really bizarre. I mean, the way Minority Impact Coalition works, it's very classic of these groups that are connected or funded by Advance or by the Institute of Public Affairs, part of broader international group called the Atlas Network of dodgy think tanks that pump money into fake academic studies, which then informs strategies for fake grassroots activist groups. What's really typical of these ones is that they will create these coalitions with token representation from different groups. You know, you have the Iranians or the Hindutva nationalists from India who provide this armor to any accusations that they are backing policies that essentially go back to white Australia, to ethno-nationalism. And they really support what's going on in Israel because that is also an ethno-state. And it's a model here for the Christian nationalists who actually run these groups like FANS and Institute of Public Affairs, because they want to set up an ethno-state for white Australians right here. You have the Iranians providing that armor, and you have the far-right Jewish people from Australian Jewish Association providing armor against any anti-Semitism. Then the white nationalists kind of hang a bit more in the background. But with Minority Impact Coalition, they put out this ridiculous ad that said Iran, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, this University of Sydney student encampment, and the Greens, all these people are actually working very closely together, Iran and ISIS, if you can believe it, and the Greens, to set up a caliphate here. It's absolutely laughable, but you'd actually be surprised that it got, you know, 10,000 different clicks, mostly positive, from different outraged commenters and people on Facebook and Instagram. This video did do the rounds. There was a lot of money put into the different ways to promote it on Meta and to make sure it got really pushed hard by the algorithm. To go back to what we were saying before, these guys see it's just never enough support for the Israel lobby. I mean, if liberals were in power, they would still be criticizing the liberals then for not supporting Israel enough. We have a Labor government, so it's not working that way right now. But if you look at Allegra Spender and the Teals, they got these nasty pamphlets that Wendy was mentioning before as well, very similar to what they did for the Greens, and was saying that, you know, Allegra Spender supports Hamas. I want to clarify, Allegra Spender is no ally of our movement. It was important that we clarify that she does not support Palestinian resistance when we were writing our articles, because we don't want to misrepresent her. She briefly supported reinstating funding for UNRWA, and then she backflipped on that when an Israel lobby group connected to Advance called the Public Integrity Australia provided her with a 50-page document saying that UNRWA is pretty much Hamas, and then published these pamphlets anyways, even though they got what they wanted out of her. They said, no, well, Allegra supports Hamas. It's just never enough for these guys. So to what extent did the Zionist lobby affect the Greens' result? My personal analysis is actually they achieved their goals. Greens actually did not take a massive hit in terms of their vote. Primary vote was about 0.05% less than 3 years ago, which was a record-breaking high. but they really targeted the Greens where it hurts, which is the lower house seats, which they've worked really hard to win in recent elections. And they did that actually very well. It wasn't just the Israel lobby. It was also coal-backed groups, mining-backed groups, all sorts of billionaires just looking to pay less business and income tax. They got what they wanted. And you would certainly expect with the Greens that when Labour's vote is surging and Labour is doing so well, that there is a little bit of, you know, crossover to the other left-wing party getting some successes in this election.
I'm really curious to address this question in terms of funding. Do we know how much is donated into political parties in general by any organization, including Israel lobbying organizations, or this is not clear?
Well, we should have real-time reporting, but we don't. The answer to that is we will get some information in the future. I think it's due at the end of August, but won't be released till November. We get some information, but there's all different ways of hiding bits of information, like through fundraising events, through other fronts. But one particular point in relation to this election will be that any donation by an organisation that was 15,000 or below. Now, I'm sure for any of us, 15,000 donation would be a massive donation, but for some people it's sort of peanuts. But if they sort of take, for example, or any of these organisations, if they have people who are separating out, like if you say do six $15,000 donations, they do need to be added up and you then need to declare the total amount. But if you have six friends and they all put in less than 15,000, you don't have to declare it. So I'm going to be very interested. We know that Zionist money and fossil fuel money in huge amounts has gone in the past, and that has been documented. For this election, we are going to have to wait. But we can be sure that both the major parties who raised a lot of money have got some very big corporate donations. I think Labour overall raised, on the analysis that was available before the election, I think Labour actually raised more than the Liberals. That question about lack of transparency in funding is a big one that goes to accountability. And if you don't know who's paying for campaigning, well, then you really, you know, you've got a whole opaqueness about what interests are involved. Worth looking carefully once it comes out. There will be analysis by independent media.
Because we hear about this being very common in the US, for example. The AIPAC is funding any candidate who is running against someone they don't want to rerun, and so on and so forth. Do we have similar thing, Yaakov? I mean, do we have any figures available?
There's nothing really quite like AIPAC here in Australia. And I think the main reason for that here is probably just because our donations, the structure of those laws is very different, but it's much more corrupt in Australia. But there are certainly a lot of loopholes to be exploited here. In America, the studies have found that I think it's 91-92% of elections in whatever sort of race you're looking at are won by the candidate that spends the biggest amount. Politics is still politics here in Australia. While it might be a lower number here, it's still pretty much the case. With the donations here, I mean, it's really just quite ridiculous. A certain spokesman for Minority Impact Coalition actually accused Wendy and I of, quote-unquote, doxing their donors, because we named, after they had denied it, that there was a GoFundMe with listed donations by billionaires, and then specifically denied any connection to those billionaires. I mean, all of this is publicly available information. They really are doing their best to hide it. The reason that this $15,000 or less donation law that Wendy talked about is there is largely, they say, to protect the identity of small donors. But I mean, to give you an example, if I had $75,000 spare, which is no easy feat in this cost of living crisis, I could give $15,000 to the Australian Jewish Association, $15,000 to the Queensland Jewish Collective, $15,000 to their Shell Minority Impact Coalition, another $15,000 to Hindu Novan Party, so the Iran Novan Party and the Hindu Association of Australia. They would just pass all that money back onto Minority Impact Coalition, and I wouldn't be a declared donor publicly. I wouldn't be on the register of public donations to that group. The way that we found out how much money Minority Impact Coalition, Better Australia were pulling in was because we found out that they have registered as a significant third party with the Australian Electoral Commission. Pretty much the definition of a significant third party is that you are required to register that if you expect that you will spend more than $300,000 in this annual year. Now, considering that it was founded as a grassroots organization, quote unquote, in the past year, I mean, it's pretty hard to believe a grassroots organization ran by two mums out of their private home raising a family have $300,000 to spare on a side project they're running as a hobby for the federal election. But they did, and the records showed that they probably spent far, far more than that, together with Better Australia as well.
One reason we knew that Minority Impact Coalition was a front for Queensland Jewish Collective is that they aren't even registered as a third-party organisation in the way that Yakov was just describing. So when I went to find out why, and I pressed the donation button on Minority Impact Coalition, I was immediately back at Queensland Jewish Collective. So then I understood that they were just a front. So, yeah, I just thought I would mention that because there's all sorts of tricky ways to get around this. It's not just these groups that do that, though. It's big third-party organisations. And maybe just to explain the third-party thing for people, these are the organisations that seek to influence the election. And they also have to register their donations. Once the data comes out, a whole lot of journalists will hopefully jump on it and do a good analysis of it.
So one of the ways that we know how much money is donated to our political parties is that there is political donations registry published by the Australian Electoral Commission. It lags significantly behind what is donated in real time. And this is one of the loopholes that is there by design to benefit the major parties. So what we saw was that the major parties and their donors, we're talking number one biggest in Australia was Anthony Pratt, a billionaire, very involved with the United Israel Appeal, Jewish guy living down in Melbourne, very close with Donald Trump as well, very big lobbyist for the military industrial complex, funds different memorials to battles in Israel. Number two is that we had, I believe it was Harry Trigoboff, billionaire real estate developer, owns Meriden, Australia, also was involved in United Israel Appeal, the Jewish Agency for Israel, Executive Council of Jewry. Number three, you have Gina Reinhart, you know, very closely associated with One Nation, mining billionaire based in Australia, the very, very far right, racist and xenophobic views. And number four, you have Frank Lowy, who owns Centre Group in Westfield, who actually participated in the Nakba and who gives money to a lot of the same projects as the other billionaire Pratt. Pratt donates to the Labour Party. What is a close friend of Trump's and Bibi Netanyahu doing donating to the Labour Party? What policies is he buying? What is he getting in return? Frank Lowy, Trigoboff, Gina Reinhart going to the Liberals. It's very, very blatant, the extent to which this election was bought and paid for. And finally, you get Advance Australia. They had raised something like $15 million in the last round of disclosures on the donations registry. Compare that with the Labour and Liberals had accumulated a total of also $15 million. So Advance is there, essentially another wing of the Liberal Party, and it is on par with both of them in terms of donations. The Greens had gotten a total of $5 million. Advance had said very blatantly they were specifically focused on tearing down the Greens. So you have Labour, Liberal, Advance, and the Israel lobby all working together to destroy the Greens, which is just dwarfed the amount of donations.
This is unbelievable amount of information. We know that there's an influence of the Israel lobby, right? We know that there's some sort of finance that keeps everything, keeps the policies on their side of narrative. But you know, when we start talking about the influence of the Israel lobby or the Zionist lobby here in Australia, people get a bit uncomfortable around these kind of, I don't know, accusation or allegations. Even though we do have some sort of evidence, these kind of allegations are labeled as anti-Semitic. You're talking about conspiracy theory and so on and so forth. How do we handle these kind of accusations? I mean, if you want to start with that, Yaakov, and then we can get Wendy's insight.
I think it's always important to begin with presenting them argument for what they do. They always try to deny that there is an Israel lobby, at least here in Australia, which is extremely rich because Mark Liebler himself describes himself as a lobbyist. Actually cut that. I'm not sure if that's correct. Sorry. Mark Liebler.
I think he does. I read in The Pearls of Irritation, he does describe himself as a lobbyist.
I'm just not sure if that's the name of the book. In America, there's no doubt with AIPAC that this is a lobby group. I mean, it's a political actions committee. That's what the PAC stands for. The Israel lobby is a global thing. And it's something that we hear a lot more about as opposed to, you know, the China lobby, the Israel lobby, Saudi Arabian lobby. Realistically, most countries will have lobby groups in other countries. The Israel lobby is particularly powerful. It isn't only propped up by Jews. It's propped up by ultra-nationalists, Christian Zionists, people with ties to the military-industrial complex. Now, there is a natural marriage happening now between, you know, these groups like Advance Australia, Institute of Public Affairs, and the Atlas Network here, because they always present themselves as traditional liberal values, as centrist, common sense people who just want freedom, prosperity, and civil rights for people. But fundamentally, it's backed by billionaires from mining and energy sectors who want to back policies that will make them an extra buck. And they launder that ideology by pumping money through think tanks, through fake grassroots astroturfing groups. Now you're seeing them merge with the Israel lobby, who present themselves as, well, we're not advocating for something political. Advocating for Israel is about advocating for Jewish national self-determination, which is a basic human right. Perhaps some of these people who call the Israel lobby an anti-Semitic trope even believe in this sort of thing, but it is there. There are all sorts of lobby groups for all sorts of different countries. The Israel lobby has a particular level of power that we do not see with other countries, perhaps besides for America here in Australia. This is not about really self-determination, because yes, every community group has a right to have self-determination. The Jewish community groups do have synagogues. We are able to wear our kippah in public safely. We do have communal representation, community groups that have access to politicians, and that is a right of any community. What is not a right of every community or every people is to set up a state, let alone an ethno-state. You don't hear about the great powerful Kurdish lobby, for example, saying that if you oppose Kurdish national self-determination, you're anti-Kurd. It just takes a very particular line. I think we do have self-determination here, and it doesn't need to be tied to a state.
Yes, well said. I mean, if you want to add to that, Wendy?
First of all, I think this argument that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic or criticism of Zionism is anti-Semitic, I do think it's weakening. It's becoming less and less, I think, convincing people, partly because of the horrors of what Israel is doing right now, every day, and the sort of thought that you can't talk about that if you do, you're anti-Semitic. And look, I've done a lot of investigative journalism in my time, and it does involve looking at the way people seek to influence power, often in ways that aren't very transparent or public. That is not unusual. When I started looking at this issue, actually one of the first things that happened, you know, I haven't been someone who's been, unlike Yaakov, who understands a huge amount about it, I have been a supporter of Palestine, but I hadn't done a lot of journalism in this area at all. And when I read transcript, which I haven't published this, on the WhatsApp group that was organised, that was making phone calls to the ABC to get Antoinette Latouffe sacked. Now, that is a really serious thing, in my view, to do, to try to exercise your power on the grounds that someone is anti-Semitic, who is simply doing their job at the ABC, to try to make phone calls and do all these things. Well, it is a sort of conspiracy, and these sort of conspiracies happen in the world quite a bit. But I am not going to not talk about that or write about that because someone might accuse me of anti-Semitism. I know that it's not anti-Semitism. Other people do too, and I think it's really become, in this parliamentary inquiry into anti-Semitism, where the students from Sydney University, including ones from Arabic backgrounds, have had to go in there and sort of be trying, you know, people trying to shut them down or abuse them for trying to stand their ground and have their views. And then somehow people suggest they're anti-Semitic. It's quite ridiculous. That's not to say I don't think anti-Semitism exists in the world. I know, of course, I know it does. But to try to use that to shut down debate is quite offensive, in my view. And it actually makes me pretty angry. And also to see that people, Jewish people, for example, Peter Slezak, they've been really tried to shut him down, abuse him, and many other Jewish people too. This is really not on, and I think we need to face it down.
We do know that there are Israel lobbying organizations, and we know that they have influence, and we should really be courageous to talk about this.
Mark Liebler wrote an article which was quoted in Pearls and Irritations in 2018. He gave a speech when he talked about his capacity
openly,
influence people like Sophie McNeil's reporting in the Middle East or Bob Carr. So there's no secret about it.
So those organizations, we know that most of them are registered charities. Recently, there's New South Wales State Labor MP Stephen Lawrence called the Zionist lobby organization AJA, the Australian Jewish Association, a hate group. And we know that's a registered charity. How do we kind of combat these organizations by exposing them that they're actually engaged in hate narrative and hate rhetoric and political activities as well, where as a charity, you're not supposed to do that. I mean, I know many people have applied to the ACNC to kind of question these kind of charity organizations, but these challenges or these emails or inquiries never led to anything material. So how do we expose these organizations? I'll go to you, Yaakov, briefly, to you, Wendy.
Australian charity landscape just really seems to be like the Wild West. I have a friend who runs a women's health centre, domestic violence refuge for women down here in the Illawarra. The hoops that she has to run and jump through to get her charity documents, her papers in order are just huge. And then you look at, you know, some of the things that are happening, and it isn't just isolated to the Israel lobby and the charities that are part of it. I mean, there's just so many charities where you just wonder, how does this pass the bar? It doesn't seem entirely fair. Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, ACNC, procedurally refuses, it's a matter of policy for them to comment on any particular charity, but there are some very handy guidelines about how to file a complaint. Anyone can file a complaint. They won't, you know, provide a public comment on any particular charity in response to it. The Australian Jewish Association appears to perhaps be in breach. I don't want to defame them in any way, perhaps be in breach of a number of their guidelines, which, according to the ACNC website, may result in a charity status being withdrawn for an organization, which things like explicitly opposing a political party or advocating for another political party, or things like breaching Australian law or Australian policies of the government, or perhaps endorsing things that are racist or racially discriminatory, and especially in terms of the charity services it provides. So we have Australian Jewish Association clearly plugging, let's say, fundraisers for settlements in the West Bank, which are Jewish-only gated communities where you have Palestinians living in constant fear of their lives, only 2 minutes drive away, being constantly attacked by armed settlers without being able to enter into the Jewish-only settlements unless they have a special work permit, which, you know, isn't even being granted anymore. if you fundraise for a Jewish-only settlement, that is a racially discriminatory charity service that is in breach of international law and of Australians' long-standing interpretation of international law.
And you have been listening to part of a webinar looking at the role of the Zionist lobby in Australian media and politics with Palestinian activist Ahmed Alabarla and journalists Wendy Bacon and Yaakov Aharon.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.